Hagan and Dan Erlander and I are going to lead a bit of a book study, discussion, review of the book by Shusaku Endo called Silence. This is a novel written by a Japanese Christian author, and it was translated, became available in America or in English when in 1976. It was written in 69, however, and published in Tokyo. I understand that he is one of the foremost novelists in Japan today. He's written a variety of things. We have some of the books here in the library and in the bookstore. And this book has been used on at least one and maybe two other occasions as a book study. And a book study is in hopes that people have read it or know something about it, because we're sort of going to spoil it by talking about it. For those of you who want to read it, you'll kind of know the ending, which is pretty critical to the story. But maybe before the discussion, Dan's going to talk a little bit about the missionary movement, which is kind of key to how this book goes.
I want to just share a little. The setting of this novel is in 17th century Japan. And Carla just mentioned, if I could say a little background about Christianity in Japan in the 17th century, and I want to say something funny. I said sure because I thought I had a book at home that had something on it. When Elmer moved to Holden Village, there's this big, ugly bookshelf in his house. I mean, really ugly. It's sagged like that. It was long. And it got down to the living room, and I kept teasing him because he kept piling books on there. And I said, this is just going to stay in your house. It'll never go out. So that's what I was teasing. So then when we got back from our trip this weekend, sure enough, it was stretched across our living room, filled with strange items and just these worthless throwaway books, you know, old paperbacks and everything. So there it is. So I was sitting there trying to find something on Christianity in Japan in the 17th century, and I looked in my books and couldn't find it, said, no, now I have to go down to the library. Then I looked at this old, black, worn-out, ancient book that Elmer had, as a joke, put on the shelf. I picked it up, and it was Laterett's History of the Expansion of Christianity, and it had six wonderful pages on Christianity in Japan in the 17th century. So this just proves that when people mean evil against you, that it can turn into evil. Christianity in Japan really goes, the date for its beginning is 1540. And the great Roman Catholic Jesuit missionary, I'm sure we've all heard of, Francis Xavier. Have you all heard Francis Xavier? And after he planted Christianity, and now when we get to Endo is a Christian Roman Catholic contemporary novelist. He knows very deeply that Christianity never really took root in Japanese soil or in the Japanese people. And part of his writing a novel like Silence or His Life of Jesus is to present a Jesus to the Japanese people that he feels will be the Jesus that the Japanese people will respond to. And in counter to that, the Jesus that the missionaries back in these years presented, Endo thinks is part of the reason Christianity really failed to take root. After Xavier, Christianity enjoyed prosperity and growth for almost a century. By 1582, it had become 1% of the population in Japan, which is a higher percentage than Christianity is today in Japan. But then new government came that wanted to unify the people, so an edict against Christianity was announced. But it wasn't really enforced until some traders from Spain communicated the idea that missionaries were in Japan to prepare Japan for a Spanish invasion. And you can see how this rumor would then turn the Japanese against the Christians. So a real persecution of the Christian church began, including what's called one of the most famous martyrdoms, I think, in church history, of the 26 Japanese Christians who were crucified in Japan. And I think the Japanese martyrs is one of the commemoration days in our Lutheran church calendar. New government came in again, and again Christianity prospered in the first part of the 17th century. Now we're moving into the century where silence takes place, and Christianity then really reached its peak in Japan, estimates as high as 750,000 Christians. But again, there was a change in policy again. New rulers in Japan wanted to unify all of Japan under Buddhism, and therefore a campaign was started to wipe out Christianity from Japan. And the more stubborn the Christians were not to commit apostasy, which is a key word of this, the more brutal the powers of Japan became. And some of the most brutal stories of martyrdom and cruel torture and treatment of Christian people happened during this time. And now this is a time that the novel takes place, and it's a historical novel. The Portuguese priest who committed apostasy was a historical character. I didn't know that.
He was.
Yeah. It's right in this old history book. The one I was thinking of is Ferreri, who is a great Portuguese missionary to Japan at this time, under torture, committed apostasy, and then turned and wrote a book in Japanese proving that Christianity is false. He's probably one, you might call him one of the great apostates, if you want to say that, of the history. For all purposes, Christianity was wiped out of Japan, except for secret gatherings and families that passed on Christianity. So when Japan was again opened in the 1800s to missionaries, it was amazing that they found families in Japan who had passed on the Ten Commandments, the Lord's Prayer, basic Christian teachings through their family history. So they found a remnant of Christians. Also, they found families that passed on Christian relics like crosses and crucifixes from family, from generation to generation. And by the time the missionaries returned in the 1800s, these families had no idea at all what these relics even were. But we were in Japan last September, visited many missionaries, many churches. A large Lutheran church in Japan has maybe 70 members and 50 people on Sunday morning. This, you get such a sense when you're there of Christianity never really has taken deep roots in this culture. And the reasons are many, and I don't think we might want to get into that one. But our first purpose tonight is to discuss this novel.
Well, I'm glad to know that person really exists. The prologue of the book puts us in a historical perspective, but since I don't know anything about the Portuguese missionary history or Japanese mission, I didn't realize.
Can I say one more thing? The way of testing whether a person is a Christian or not that is in the novel, and that is to put a picture of Christ or Mary and the Christ child on the ground and then have people step on it or trample on it, was used through a long time in this persecution. And up until the 1700s, this method was used to put a picture of Christ on the ground, and then if a person would step on it, that would be the sign that the person was committing apostasy. If the person wouldn't step on it, then the torture would continue. So that also, which is a main part of the book, was the actual technique that was used.
That's called Fumi or Fumier or...
No, I couldn't ever pronounce it.
F-U-M-I-E, and I didn't put it up. But, well, I put a few characters, well, the main characters and some of the key words on the board for your quick reference. I will briefly retell the story. It begins written in a letter form from Sebastian Rodriguez back to, you guessed, to his home parish or a professor at seminary or the bishop of the church or somebody in Portugal. So you have kind of like a diary or a daily log approach to what's happening and his experiences as he travels to Japan and then once he's there. As Dan said, this is a 17th century Portuguese priest on a mission to Japan in which he embarked with a fellow priest whose name is Garpe. They travel together and they don't have open trade between Portugal and Japan, so they spend some time in Macau waiting to get clearance to board a Japanese or an Indian vessel which will carry them on in to Japan. And there they meet one Japanese person who turns out to be a key character in the book. His name is Kichijiro. And he is repeatedly described as one of the most despicable characters that anybody would ever want to meet. And you'd especially not want to entrust your whole life to him as these two priests had to do. He was drunk at the time that they met him. He had a beaten look. He had a very humiliated, he was referred to as a wounded dog, as a sly, very untrustworthy character. And just from every appearance and every possible conversation that Sebastian had or that Garpe had with him, he was not trusting this character. But he's the one that got them on the Japanese boat, got them safely to Japan, got them off, and put them in connection with Japanese Christians. The Christians that they found, they were amazed at. They had a community, they had a church, they had a whole sense of organization in which there were the people who were teaching the Bible, or catechetics, that's it. They were teaching the faith to other Japanese. But they knew immediately that they had to go into hiding, that they could not be open. There had been some years that were not long past when it was very acceptable to be a Christian. But those years were past, and their lives were threatened, and the lives of the people who were Christian were also threatened by their presence. But nonetheless, they built a hut up in the hill, which was not far from the town where the other Japanese Christians were living, cared for them up there, bringing them food once a day and coming in and receiving the sacraments, asking for confession and absolution. They came in contact at that time with, well, Monica is one of the women who thought that was kind of ironic, that Monica is the mother of Augustine. She had taken a Christian name, and there was another man, I think his name was Juan, too, and those are the only people who had taken Christian names. The rest of them, Mokichi, Ishizu, and Omatsu, were part of the hierarchy of this community of Christians, and we followed them through the book. Let me talk a little bit more about Kichijiro. Kichijiro puts him in touch and also has a very keen sense about what's going on across the land, not only with this community that he first brought them to, but other communities. He would come and go, and he was not part of a community, and that always always made Sebastian wonder why he didn't have any connections. He was always referring to him as a Judas-type character, and he was uncomfortable when Kitchajiro was around and always had the sense that he was going to deny him or deny Christ, which he soon realizes that he does. And he was always saying, "What thou doest, do quickly," the words of Christ to Judas. And when the samurai, who were the people entrusted to keep the law, knew then that the two priests were there, they had to break them up, and they went on the run. And Sebastian went one way, and Garpe went the other way. Sebastian was walking alone for a long time, and then all of a sudden became aware that there was another person on the same trail. This person then, of course, became Kitchajiro, who was always showing up. And not too long after that, then the guards showed up, and Kitchajiro had made a reference to, they pay 300 pieces of silver if I bring in a priest, or if a priest is found. And of course, he just knew then that he would be arrested. Kitchajiro does not attempt to cover his weakness. He very willingly humbles himself, is in a kind of always apologizing for his presence, and struggles with his weakness. Struggles with that and says, what about the Christians 10 or 15 or 20 years ago? They never faced martyrdom. So we may think they were strong, but yet they never put their faith to the test like he did. As the story unfolds, he had apostated prior to the time that he brought Sebastian into the country, and he did at least twice during the book. I'm not sure, it kind of repeats itself. He's alienated from the others, so he's both free to travel throughout the country and be in touch with what's happening with Christians throughout the land, and also that's his burden, that he doesn't have a community, but he is kind of accepted as part of the church universal, so therefore does have more of a sense of the church universal in Japan, which was certainly a seedling at that time. He keeps Sebastian a priest. He demands that he be cared for in a pastoral kind of way, and at the same time he then denies and has Sebastian arrested so that he's prohibited from practicing his priestly responsibilities. Rodriguez sees the suffering of the people, the many martyrs who are crucified because of their belief in Christ, and that really is how he kind of agonizes over the silence of God. He sees that as failure of God to answer his prayers. He has an image of Christ, which is a very beautiful, a very Western kind of an image of a very strong, a very powerful, a blue-eyed Christ. And that's the image that carries him through. But that also is the image that is silent to him. He struggled with whether or not God exists, but he couldn't fathom that. He couldn't fathom equating God's existence with the silence. He meditated on the martyrs. He visioned himself as a martyr and offered himself instead of the people who were having to be martyred as a result of their beliefs. He felt that that should be him. He expected martyrdom to be a glorious kind of an end, kind of a revelation, and of course it wasn't. It was very painful. It was not at all filled with the glory that I guess he had imagined. He was imprisoned, and after many, many pleas from the samurai and this fellow in Inouye, I-N-O-U-E, he was billed as being just, I guess, the evilest of all people. He was creating all of the tortures And he was outsmarting the church at every turn. And he was the one that would be there when they said, stamp on the fumi or the fumier apostate, and he would never. And Sebastian didn't do it through most of the book. Okay, then comes the night. There are all kinds of parallels through this about Holy Week, about Good Friday, about when he's being imprisoned, when they've rounded him up and they're riding him through the towns on some sort of animal. He's remembering Christ's journey through Jerusalem on during Holy Week and on Good Friday. And he carries that as his own victory, that he is able to smile and kind of defy these people who are punishing him. And he looks at martyrdom in a vain way, and he realizes that toward the end that is his cherished dream, to be a martyr. And he's convinced that he will not commit apostasy. His friend Garpe is found, and as a result of his not apostating, he witnesses the death of Ishizu and Mokichi. Both die when Garpe fails to commit apostasy. And at the last minute, Sebastian says, he asks and he pleads with him to apostate, and he didn't. But he still had the sense that as a priest, he would not allow himself to do that. Okay, so he's been in prison for a long time now. He's been taken through the streets. He's been exposed to all kinds of humiliation, but has remained firm in his beliefs. And on this last night, they said, "You will surely apostate tonight." So we spend a lot of time looking at that night. He's taken into a cell which is, he can put his hands on both sides of the wall. He puts his feet up on the sides of the wall because the bottom of it is full of urine, and he doesn't know what. And as he's sitting there, it's completely dark. He keeps hearing these noises, this snoring. And he was sure that it was the guard outside the door who was, you know, taking his job very leisurely and had fallen asleep on him. So he's annoyed by that, but he proceeds to kind of adjust, to think that this is his life then as a martyr, that he will be confined to this cell. As he's feeling around, he comes across the letters Laudate Eum, which is Latin. It means for all creation to praise God. And he was overwhelmed, like there's a connection here. He knows someone else had shared this cell. And then not too much long later than that, Ferrari, did I tell you, you said who Ferrari was, didn't you? I can't remember if I said. Yeah, Ferrari comes, and he'd always asked through all of his travels, who knew Ferrara, and who knew what was if the story of his apostasy was true? And people never spoke of that willingly. They didn't. They would ignore him, or ignore his question. So finally, he meets him on this last night, and Ferrara tells him then that the snoring that he hears is not the snoring of the guard, but it's the moaning of people outside his cell who are hanging in a pit, over a pit, by their feet, with slits in either their temple or behind their ears to prolong their death. And then all of a sudden he becomes overwhelmed then that these people are dying because of him, because of his failure to deny Christ. And now I'm going to let the book tell you or explain how this... Okay, so again, the fumier is presented to him, and he looks at it.
That's the picture.
That's the picture. It's
the
a
image.
Simple copper metal is fixed on a gray plank of dirty wood on which the grains run like waves. Before him is the ugly face of Christ, crowned with thorns and the thin outstretched arms, eyes dimmed and confused. The priest silently looks down at the face, which he now meets for the first time since coming to this country. Ah, Ferreira says, courage. And the guards keep telling him, and over again they've said, this is just a formality. Just do this to please us, to please the government. Just step on this face. So again they're saying, it's only a formality. What do formalities matter? And the interpreter is excited and urges him, only go through with the exterior form of the trampling. And then the priest, Sebastian, raises his foot. In it he feels a dull, heavy pain. This is no mere formality. He will now trample on what he has considered the most beautiful thing in his life, on what he has believed most pure, on what is filled with the ideals and the dreams of man. How his foot aches. And then the Christ in bronze speaks to the priest. Trample, trample. I more than anyone know the pain of your foot. Trample. It was to be trampled on by men that I was born into this world, and it was to share men's pain that I carried my cross. The priest placed his foot on the fumier. Dawn broke. And far in the distance, the cock crew. So he did then trample on the face of Christ. His life then is changed. He takes on the identity of a Japanese Christian who had someone who had died anyway, had been a Japanese Christian. He's called into the government's office about once a week or once a month or something to just check in to make sure that so they know what he's doing. He's writing books for them, translating books on science. Ferrara translates books in medicine and astronomy, and felt like he was doing more for the Japanese people than his attempts to bring Christianity to him, to that country. And then in, I guess, the last scene before the epilogue where we get the dates, we have a scene where Kichijiro comes back and Sebastian is no longer Sebastian. Sebastian is Okedo Sanemon. And all the kids in the street know who he is, and they sing songs to him, and they call him the Apostate Paul. And Ferrara is known as the Apostate Peter. So his life wasn't, it was well known to the world who he was, or to his neighborhood who he was. And still in this life, Kichijiro comes to him and expects Sebastian to be a priest, to hear his confession. And this is the last paragraph. He heard Kichijiro's confession, offered absolution. Since in this country there is now no one else to hear your confession, I will do it. Say the prayers after confession. Go in peace. Kichijiro wept softly. Then he left the house. The priest had administered that sacrament that only a priest can administer. No doubt his fellow priests would condemn his act as sacrilege, but even if he was betraying them, he was not betraying his Lord. He loved him now in a different way from before. Everything that had taken place until now had been necessary to bring him to this love. Even now I am the last priest in this land, but our Lord was not silent. Even if he had been silent, my life until this day would have spoken of him. Okay, well, that's the story. I guess I'd like to hear comments, maybe first from those who have read it and kind of some of their reactions, and then from the rest of you.
I thought it was kind of interesting that they made such a big deal of trampling on the fumi, or whatever it was called, because it could have been just a formality for him to do that, but it wasn't, because after he did it, then he felt like he was no longer a priest, and it was just the way he looked at it, and it was strange to me that they made it apostasy. It needn't have been.
Well, along with that, when Ishizu and Mokichi were faced with that, Kichijiro was also faced with apostasy, stomping on the fumi at the same time. And when they stomped on the fumi, the guards weren't satisfied. That wasn't enough for them, even though they'd said all along to Sebastian that would be enough. They said that he had to call the Virgin a whore in order to satisfy them. And Kichijiro could. He could do that. But Mokichi and Ishizu weren't able to do that, and so they died a martyr's death, even though they had trampled, even though they had complied with the formality.
What point do you think the author might have been trying to make in the novel?
Parallel that I drew, and this is probably way out, but I kept thinking that the priest kept thinking of himself in terms of Christ in so many of the ways that he was, he suffered and such. And I kept thinking about Kichijiro as being all Christians, showing the weaknesses and showing the instability under pressure and such things. And when they finally came to the end of the story, they were both sort of victors, like Christ was and like Christians are. That's the parallel I got out of it.
And what a character to have to identify with, being a Christian.
Mm-hmm. But he came through,
yeah,
at times.
Uh-huh. He was the faithful.
That's probably digging deep, but that's what I came up with.
He always kept coming back. And he was a professional apostate.
Just, he knew the ropes.
Well, he sinned and he was forgiven. He was sinned, he sinned again.
And he knew that
it happened over and over.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like anybody gets out unscathed, so to speak. You know, nobody gets out righteous. Not at least the way you presented it. I haven't read it.
I guess I never saw Rodriguez as being particularly scathed. I mean, I understand about the apostasy.
Uh-huh.
know, but I guess I didn't. I didn't think, thought that he was portrayed with that line. And that he was doing what he thought Christ would do in the same situation.
Except that I think that after he gives up his priesthood, and it, except for that one instance with Kitajiro.
But he thought Christ would give up his priesthood in the same situation. But it was his duty. He thought Christ was calling him to do that.
What was striking to me, he throughout the book he draws the parallels between two pictures, two artistic representations of Christ. One was his old picture from Portugal, you know, and Endo really explains that it would be the picture in our church would show the glorious, victorious, risen Christ, you know, the one with Christ like a triumphant king with his foot up on the tomb holding a banner of victory. And this was the picture that was always silent, never spoke to him. But yet, I think Endo was saying this is a Christ that was brought to Japan. You know, then this Fume, you know, that just spoke. And I think that's where the title of the book comes from, Silence. That finally the silence was broken as this picture said, trample me, trample me. And it was a cry, it was Christ. Whole life was to be trampled upon, and then I identified so much because I've always thought, my goodness, if it came down to the crunch, I wouldn't deny Jesus. Have we all said that?
Yeah.
Or I would hope I would not deny Jesus. But what if other Christians were hanging upside down and were in extreme torture and pain and torment, and with special operation to keep them conscious so they would suffer longer. And as long as I did not commit apostasy, they would continue to suffer. And it was at that point that then Rodriguez hears the voice of the battered Christ that has been trampled on for years, saying, trample me for them. And then Sebastian dies. He dies as a Westerner. He dies as a priest. He dies as a Christian with integrity. I mean, how many of us have thought, at least I'll maintain my integrity? He does all of this for others. You know, and you end up, when you read this book, you end up with really terrible feelings of ambiguity. And any feeling of glory and martyrdom that you ever had, Endo devastates by this book. That's
what you just said reminded me of a quote I wanted to read about sin, how he's in prison and, you know, he continues to say his prayers and his patters and his aves, and he does them on his hands, and because he doesn't have any of his Christian symbols. But anyway, he's in a cell now, and he's trying to define, this is a very intellectual book, and he's trying to define sin for himself. And sin, he reflected, is not what is usually thought to be. It is not to steal and tell lies. Sin is for one man to walk brutally over the life of another and to be quite oblivious of the wounds he has left behind. And then for the first time, a real prayer rose up in his heart. So I think, you know, like Jim's commenting about his not being scathed through it, I guess I see him being scathed on a real kind of intellectual, emotional basis through this whole thing, because that's where, I mean, that's how we know of his struggles.
I also thought of the rest of his life as being a martyrdom too, in that it was completely controlled. He had no freedom, and he lived, what, for another 30 years? In this complete control in a situation that he would never have chosen for himself.
He was absolutely confined and without any sort of peers.
He had to do whatever they told him to do.
Mm-hmm. He never met Ferrara for any kind of reconciliation. They greeted each other. Ferrara had been his mentor, and he was his beloved teacher. And he was never able to come to terms with that, and yet they saw each other regularly. But it was so controlled that the guards would hear every conversation that they had.
Even Kichijiro couldn't see him without guards being present.
So did he do the right thing by trampling on the image?
Can I stand
up? Well, we should vote.
Shall we vote?
I can tell a church body you came out of.
Identifying with people here or in the book who believe that they wouldn't reject Christ. That's foreign. I just assume I probably would.
Guess I said I was hope. I hope I wouldn't. You know, or I would.
That seems to be kind of a paradox. So, I haven't read the book, but the way you explained it, the last part, to step on Christ. Seems like that would have been the apostate type thing to do. Yet that was what the Christ was ordering to do. It was kind of like which one is apostasy? Stepping or not stepping? In the situation when the Christ says step, and you don't, that would seem to be apostasy. In other words, not.
I was dealing with the book. I was dealing with an attitude towards the book that you come to that I wouldn't identify with somebody who would apostatize. I would apostatize. But and I probably would have dodged the message of the symbol to trample me if that meant that what I was supposed to do with Christ. In other words, I don't see myself as that strong withstanding all of the pressures that would be there. But in the book, as you're saying, maybe I would be a hero and do what Christ wanted me to do.
To me, it's...
Well, I kept thinking how stupid the government was there. torture, to use that particular method to try to stamp out a religion. If I were going to try to stamp out a religion, I would do it by enduring it.
Kind of like we do here in this country.
Yeah.
That's a way to stamp it out.
But it did work. I mean, Christianity was, for all practical, stamped out.
It did work.
Well, I don't know. I saw that the stepping was the final parallel with Christ, the mercy of him.
Yeah.
He was showing his mercy for the people that were in the pit. That was really the main reason why.
That
was his mercy for them, and that was the parallel with Christ, his mercy for us.
I think Rodriguez is more of an apostasy because he wouldn't accept Christ's mercy than that he's trampled on it. Because after that, after he walked on it, he considered himself no longer a Christian.
Yes, he did.
You think he did?
And he didn't define himself as Christian, but it didn't interfere with his it didn't interfere with his beliefs. But he couldn't call himself Christian. There's no way in which he could be Christian in an outward sort of way. But he said
he unworthy.
He remained in loving toward Christ, and their relationship had a new dimension, which I think is Christian as long as he continued to believe.
Related to that was a little bit what was his definition of Christian was it was subject to what he saw as the formal truth.
Yeah.
You know, that day. And I think you're right in terms of the word. He didn't consider it. He didn't think that he met the formal requirements. But he thought he had done the thing that Christ would have done.
I haven't forgotten your question, Norm. Do you want to answer his question? What was the point?
The definitive answer, right? Okay. Have that written down?
Yeah.
I can't. Yeah, I don't. This doesn't answer it, but the more you get acquainted a little with Endo and what Endo is, as I understand, is trying to do in Japan, and that becomes more clear when you read his life of Jesus, available also in paperback.
Yes.
We have to remember when you read these books in English, they were not written for us. They were written for Japanese people who were not Christians, basically. And the old picture that he brought over from Portugal, I think Endo is saying that is the Christ that was preached in Japan through the centuries, and that is the reason that Christianity never took root in Japan. And in the life of Jesus, he explains how the Japanese people would be open to a merciful, compassionate, suffering, taking pain, mothering, feminine. He uses the word feminine, Jesus. You know, and that's that he thinks that the Japanese people have a natural affinity to God in those categories, you might say. So I think in the novel, the trampled Christ is a Christ that he feels Japan would be open to. I think it's a missionary novel, not a missionary because it's an indigenous evangelistic novel, I think. That's why I understand it. I don't know how definitive that is.
They're not hanging in the pits nowadays.
No, they're ignoring.
I received an application from a young Lutheran woman who has been a missionary in Japan for the past 2 years today. And she is really saying that she feels like she really needs a supportive Christian community and really wants that right now. Upon the return from Japan.
Is there a limit to the number of missionaries in Japan right now? I think I was talking to a guest who had a friend who was going over there in some sort of other capacity, but whose primary purpose was as a missionary, but he couldn't call himself a missionary because they were over the limit.
It's true
in India,
isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, I'm just third hand.
Another response I'd have is bringing this novel back to our culture and our society. Do we try to present a glorious Jesus who's successful, you know, who promises wonder and glory and power and success and miracles and proof that if you believe in this Jesus, it's going to work? This is the picture of Christ he brought from Portugal, or do we share a Jesus who says trample? Or what kind of Jesus is my picture or my image?
And does my Jesus ask me then to give up my cherished dreams? And if my cherished dream is to be a martyr, or if it is to be an educator, or whatever it is, and then all of a sudden that's not in the works, can I do that?
Is that, how simplified is that then, if you don't apostatize because you have a Portuguese Jesus, that you certainly will apostatize, you will not then apostatize if you have a travel Baptist Jesus?
I don't understand.
Is
Are they the same?
Well, I don't know. That's what I'm asking. Is it as distinct as Endo makes it? Would not a trampled on Jesus become another idol? Or is it that, you know, by doing, is it again, you do certain things in order to be Christian? I guess I'm not so clear that the simplicity of rejecting a manufactured Jesus, a Portuguese, made in Portugal, Jesus, for a made in Japan Jesus, solves anything. Would it really, I guess is what I'm asking.
I think that raises one of the other questions that the book, I think, raises, which is, what do you do in the face of the silence of God? I mean, and I think that's asked in many different ways throughout the book, in many different situations. And what is your response in the face of that?
That I think people in Portugal and Japan face.
And you come in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Another way to phrase it is, in, you know, in a way, like the Gospel of Mark, does Mark present a trampled on Jesus in contrast to a gilded Jesus? So is Endo not leading us to like a Japanese Jesus as much as the Jesus of the Gospels would be? Especially Mark's gospel, I think, any more than.
Well, Jesus forgave Peter for denying him three times.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't have the feeling that he ever really forgave Kichijiro until the very last, and he wasn't even able to absolve. I mean, by his definition of what he could do, he didn't feel like he was no longer a priest, so he couldn't absolve. But he did forgive finally, and I think that was his accident.
When you read the book, Kichijiro would be the hardest person in the entire world to forgive.
Yes.
Just
seems to have no redeeming. Except
you can say his name, and that's worth something. I can't say the first names.
Okay, I think another interesting character is, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, is it Anui or whatever his name is? Anyway, he's the person that all the missionaries fear and are in terror of when they arrive in Japan, because they've heard so many stories about his torture and the techniques he uses. And then when Rodriguez finally meets him, he's like this very civilized, kind man to begin with. And I think that's a really interesting twist, too.
Even nodding his head and agreeing.
He listens, yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Is he Buddhist? Excuse me? Is he Buddhist?
It doesn't really say.
It's really sort of implied, but there will.
He was a Christian at one time in the apostate. Wasn't he the one?
No, that was Ferrara.
No, I think
Inouye
did too. He was
apostate.
He was trained in a seminary.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right, yeah.
During
okay,
the time when it was acceptable.
When it was politically advantageous to be Christian, you get a good education. Seminary. Yeah. Well, anybody else want to offer their summation or what they think the point of the book was. It's good reading. It came to America after having well established its reputation in Japan, and his books are getting published more quickly here now, so they are becoming more available. I have another one on order. We have two novels and then The Life of Jesus here in the bookstore.
Maybe Dan or somebody else who has read The Life of Jesus could make a comment. Is that easy reading? Is it intriguing? What do you want to say about it?
Big print.
Yeah, big print.
Yeah.
Small price tag.
A smaller print.
He combines the Gospels and just tells the story. But then he stops all the time and comments on biblical scholars and what they have said. It's interesting how you get a Japanese perspective of New Testament scholarship, kind of weaves that through the story, you know. And then he tries, from his perspective, to recreate Jesus and the Palestinian situation and what Jesus was actually like. It's good Lenten reading if you want. You can read it before, but if you want something good for Lent. Yeah. Also, the novel Silence, I've read the reviews of, I guess you call them secular reviewers and everything, that he's highly regarded as a novelist. And the comment I've heard more than once is it's a novel where there isn't one word in the novel that isn't necessary. Mm. You know, some novels will ramble. But had you heard that or read that? Or
he's compared to Graham Greene.
Graham Greene.
Power and Glory. Yeah.
What is
the Whiskey Priest? You can hardly.
What?
Well, thank you. We can go in silence.
We want to thank you for this session.